Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Struggling to keep up with your toddler? We know a hotel that'll keep them entertained. Book family-friendly hotels with pools in the Hotels.com app to find your perfect somewhere.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 6th of March, these are our main stories. Joe Biden and Donald Trump sweep to victory on Super Tuesday, but it's all over for the Republican presidential hopeful Nikki Haley. Yulia Navalny, the widow of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, calls for an election day protest against President Vladimir Putin. The World Food Programme says the war in Sudan could trigger the world's largest hunger crisis. Also in this podcast, a call to dispense with touchscreens in cars and go back to buttons for reasons of safety. And
even if one or two of the kids that play on the instruments that I repaired go on to great things, you know, it's just so worth it.
The LA repair shop fixing musical instruments for free. As we record this podcast, Donald Trump is on the brink of securing the Republican presidential nomination, having cruised to victory in nearly all the state primaries held on Super Tuesday, the biggest voting day in the U.S. ahead of the presidential election itself. His only Republican rival, Nikki Haley, is now reported to be preparing to pull out. So it now looks like a rematch between Mr. Trump and President Joe Biden is almost inevitable. Yet opinion polls suggest most Americans are unhappy about the choice they'll have to make in November, as Will Vernon reports.
Another triumph for Trump. The former president swept the board on Super Tuesday, securing his position as the unassailable frontrunner. At a rally in Florida, Mr. Trump said his victory was historic.
Well, thank you very much. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one. And they tell me, the pundits and otherwise, that there's never been one like this. There's never been anything so conclusive.
I project that former President Trump has won the state of Texas.
The president will win the state of Massachusetts. And
officially, he hasn't won the nomination yet. But with results like these, total victory seems certain.
Super Tuesday or Snoozer Tuesday.
President Joe Biden also swept the board in the Democrat primaries. Here in Washington, the Super Tuesday atmosphere, compared to previous years, is rather flat. As expected, Joe Biden and Donald Trump have swept the board and are now almost certain to be going head-to-head in the election come November. If all of this seems familiar, well, that's because it is. Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden faced off in the 2020 election too. It's a rematch that most people here just don't want.
I can't hear any other voices but those two now, and I don't like that. There should be more people.
We only have two really old people, like people who should be retired.
It's become polarizing. I wish that people would focus more on what we have in common, because I think there's so much more that we have in common than different.
A man indicted on 91 charges across four criminal cases versus the oldest sitting president in history, who faces questions about his mental fitness for office. Around 70% of Americans say they don't want another Trump versus Biden election.
Donald Trump has greater intensity. People who love him and hate him.
Frank Luntz is a Republican pollster and political consultant.
Joe Biden, it's not quite as intense, but you either support Joe Biden to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president, or you oppose Joe Biden because you want Donald Trump to become president. I've never seen politics so toxic and frankly, dangerous this early in a presidential campaign in my entire professional life.
Big night. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Donald Trump has a small lead over Joe Biden in most polls, but Election Day is still 8 months away, and many Americans already seem weary of the campaign and of an increasingly polarized political climate.
Will Vernon. Well, much of the focus is now turning on to whether Nikki Haley will throw her support behind Mr. Trump. With more on her campaign, here's another one of our correspondents in Washington, Anthony Zerka.
She lost 14 of the 15 state contests last night on Super Tuesday. And mathematically, the numbers were just becoming incredibly daunting. Donald Trump was just a few hundred delegates away from securing the nomination. No matter what Nikki Haley did, he probably would reach that mark next week. So the writing was on the wall, and you know, she had accomplished what she sought to do in Super Tuesday, which was stay there and give a lot of voters in America an option. But it was difficult to imagine her getting continued financial support to keep her campaign going, or even why she would want to for the remaining states that dribble out over the next couple of months.
And she's expected to speak in the next couple of hours. And a key question will be, is she going to endorse Donald Trump now that he is the sole Republican candidate? Because he really does need to extend his appeal beyond his very loyal base.
That is the key question, and reports, at least as of now, are that she will not announce an endorsement for Donald Trump in this speech later this morning from her home of Charleston, South Carolina, that she will say that Donald Trump needs to do more to reach out to her voters and convince them to support him. It is going to be an interesting test to see if Donald Trump can do that. If you look at exit polls from several of the states that voted last night, there were large segments of Nikki Haley's support that appear reluctant to support Donald Trump. And now, while back in 2016, there were certainly Republican voters who didn't vote for Donald Trump and then came around and supported him back then, that does mean that Donald Trump is going to have some work to do to broaden his base, because he's going to need those Nikki Haley supporters, which were college-educated voters, suburban voters, wealthier voters, in order to build a coalition that can win the White House for him in November.
But a lot of people in the U.S. are really not very excited by this result. They think they've got 8 months of an angry, divisive campaign. And a lot of people will be going, oh, no, not again, Biden versus Trump.
The polls do indicate that many Americans, a majority of Americans, don't want this matchup, certainly don't want a rematch. They want someone younger. They want someone who might be able to run a more energetic, optimistic campaign. But as you mentioned, that is not the campaign we're going to get. We're going to get 8 months of both candidates predicting doom and gloom if their opponent wins. And I think you're going to see a general election campaign where both candidates are hopping around the map to key swing states, making campaign appearances like they both did in Texas last week. And they are both going to do in Georgia, which is definitely a swing state, on Saturday. It's going to feel like a very, very long campaign because they are already focused on each other and they are going to go dark and negative very quickly.
Anthony Zerka. Alexei Navalny's widow has urged Russians to treat this month's presidential election as an opportunity to protest against Vladimir Putin. Yulia Navalnaya called the election a sham, which would end in whatever result Mr. Putin wanted. She has vowed to take up the mantle of her dead husband, who was a leading opposition voice in Russia, despite only narrowly escaping an assassination attempt and then being imprisoned for years. His supporters have pinned the blame for his sudden death in a penal colony last month on Mr. Putin. Here's our Europe regional editor, Alice Adley.
Yulia Navalnaya, who lives in exile, has issued a call on YouTube to compatriots to come out in force to register their opposition to President Putin in the elections later this month, the result of which most observers believe is a foregone conclusion, his re-election. Many commentators do not expect the election to be either free or fair. Instead, they say the process will be dominated by Mr. Putin, who's been accused of increasing political repression ever since launching his full-scale war with Ukraine in 2022. When Mr. Navalny died in mysterious circumstances in a penal colony in northern Russia in mid-February, Vladimir Putin's main opponent was wiped away, even though he had already been barred from standing. For several days in Moscow last week, thousands of people visited his grave to lay flowers and to pay their respects. His widow, Yulia, said she had drawn hope from the large crowds. She urged people to go to polling stations and send a clear message to President Putin about the opposition to his rule.
We can still use that so-called election to achieve our goals. We need to show that we exist and that there are many of us. We need to go to polling stations on the same day and time, noon of March 17th. It is up to you to choose what to do next. You can vote for any candidate but Putin. You can spoil the ballot. You can write on it in big letters, Navalny.
Yulia Navalnaya's call for her late husband's supporters to come to polling stations at midday on the last of 3 days of voting could potentially result in their detention or worse. There were almost no arrests at Alexei Navalny's funeral, but it's always a possibility in Russia's increasingly repressive political environment.
Alice Adley. While the eyes of the world have been focused on Gaza, for weeks now the UN World Food Programme has been warning of an unfolding catastrophe in Sudan. As warring factions battle for control of the country, the WFP says it's been receiving reports that people are dying of starvation in Sudan and that millions more are facing acute hunger. It's extremely difficult for aid agencies to get into Sudan, where vast swathes of the population have been displaced. Many have crossed the border into South Sudan to try to escape the violence. Speaking on a visit to a transit camp at Renk in South Sudan, the head of the WFP, Cindy McCain, issued this statement on the UN organization's website.
The war in Sudan is sending millions spiraling into what could soon be the world's largest hunger crisis. In South Sudan, I've met mothers and children who have fled violence many times. They've escaped the fighting, but they struggle to escape the hunger.
Our deputy Africa editor, Anne Soy, is monitoring the situation in Sudan from Nairobi.
The World Food Programme is estimating that about 25 million people, both inside Sudan and those who have fled to neighbouring countries, are facing food insecurity. And the situation is getting worse by the day. They have warned that many people are at risk of going into the highest level of hunger. They call it a hunger catastrophe unless something is done. In the long term, they think that what would have a lasting solution was to end the war. But there's no end in sight to the war that has been raging since last April between the two rival forces in Sudan.
Is there any kind of outside mediation? Because I seem to remember that a US envoy was recently appointed.
That's right. There has been a concerted effort to bring the warring sides together, both by the regional governments in the Horn of Africa, as well as Arab states. There have been efforts supported by Western nations, including the United States. But so far, they have failed to yield a lasting solution. That just days ago, the leaders of these warring sides have been hosted in Libya, in the Tripoli-based government. And so there are multiple efforts to try and find a solution, but none in sight yet.
Anne Soy, are cars becoming far too minimalist for their own good? A lot of new models have fancy touchscreens, but some in the industry are worried they aren't as safe as using old-fashioned buttons. Now a European safety body is introducing new guidance that will require cars to have physical controls to receive a 5-star safety rating. Tim Frank spoke to the motoring journalist Ginny Buckley.
Euro NCAP, who are the automotive safety industry body in Europe, is introducing new guidance from 2026. And what this is basically saying is that 5 what they consider key tasks in every car will have to be performed by actually using an actual button or a stalk or a dial. And those tasks are indicators, hazard warning lights, windscreen wipers, the horn and some SOS features. And I guess this is all down to something called the rise of the touchscreen, which seems to be in every single car we see these days.
It is proliferating, isn't it? Has it got to the point with new cars where there is a sense of, you know, actually there aren't any buttons. I mean, it is all touchscreens. Has it reached that point yet?
Yeah, it has reached saturation point, I think. And indeed, the latest car that we've seen from Volvo, which is the Volvo EX30, if you looked up Scandi minimalism, you know, on one of those AI image generators, you would see a picture of this car's interior because it has nothing. There is a screen and a steering wheel. You access everything through that. You adjust the mirrors, you access your demister, you adjust the steering wheel height. You even though need to go through two menus to turn on the fog lights. So this is where I think it's getting slightly ridiculous. I mean, I personally really like these big infotainment screens. I think they can be very useful, but I do want to see physical buttons in the car for those key functions. And I actually don't think Euro NCAP have gone far enough. I think we should see physical buttons be mandatory for things like controlling your climate control, the volume on your car. Those are things you do a lot when you're driving and it should be easy to do.
It might seem like a worryingly obvious point, but it clearly needs to be made, is that, you know, these are decisions that and sort of manoeuvres and changes that people are trying to make when they are driving a ton of metal at high speed. I mean, you really need to be able to do this with the minimum amount of fuss and looking away from the road.
Yeah, indeed, it's a really good point. And in fact, road safety campaigners are concerned that rises that we've seen in accidents are perhaps down to people just glancing away to look at touchscreens. I think what the car makers would say, and certainly in the case of Volvo, is they've got a very good voice activation system. So if you can really get on with that, and it's a system that really understands what you're saying, you know, sometimes being northern on certain words, they don't always understand what I'm saying. But if you have a good voice activation system, then it should take away that need to stab away in a menu looking for things. But I really do think, as you say, some of those key functions, the things you're using all the time, they should be there, you know, at your fingertips.
Given those concerns, why do you think car designers, car makers are going down this route?
So I think there's a couple of reasons playing into this. One is it reduces the costs, and the second is it can reduce emissions. So first of all, we look at costs. The less parts you have to manufacture for a car, the more you can keep the cost down. And we know that particularly with electric cars at the moment, they are a premium over their petrol and diesel counterparts. So that's a good thing. The second thing, though, is carbon emissions. So manufacturers really need to look at the overall emissions of a car made during its lifetime. So that includes the manufacturing and the supply chain, not just those emissions that it may or may not emit as it drives down the road. So by, again, reducing those parts, you can reduce the overall emissions. And in fact, we've seen a really interesting thing recently. It's not actually, you know, doing away with switches and buttons. It's doing away with a windscreen. So the new car from Polestar, the Polestar 4, doesn't have a rear window in that car. You know, they've done it for a number of reasons. There are fantastic cameras in there that take the place of that windscreen. But by reducing that very heavy part, it's helping to reduce that car's emissions.
Motoring journalist Ginny Buckley. Still to come on this podcast, Haiti's gangs tighten their grip on the country and...
They look to me a bit like the sort of lights that you might put on a bicycle. So obviously you wouldn't go out at night without lights on your bicycle. And this is doing a similar sort of thing.
A bright idea to save thousands of sea turtles from being killed by fishing nets, flashing lights.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Struggling to keep up with your toddler? We know a hotel that'll keep them entertained. Book family-friendly hotels with pools in the Hotels.com app to find your perfect somewhere.
The Block is about building community around Black music. Music that shapes culture. With beats that feed our hearts. Melodies that make our memories. And rhythms that shape our lives. They say you are what you hear. And when you hear The Block, you know that you belong. Join me, Angeline Tetteweo, on The Block. Weeknights at 7 on CBC Music. Or anytime on the CBC Listen app.
Oh.
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Let's turn to Nigeria now, where dozens of displaced people have been abducted by suspected Boko Haram jihadists in the northeastern state of Borno. Officials say the victims, most of them female, were seized when they were collecting firewood in a forest. Myeni Jones reports from Lagos.
There are lots of conflicting reports about what exactly happened in Ingala this weekend. Even the day the victims were taken is contested, with sources in the area disagreeing on whether it happened Friday, Saturday or Sunday. What we know is that a number of internally displaced people from a camp in Ingala near the border with Cameroon were abducted. Most appear to have been women and girls who were collecting firewood to sell and use for cooking. Local militia leaders told the AFP news agency only 47 women are still missing. The authorities in Borno State have not yet confirmed the number of abductees. The incident comes as the government of Borno in northeast Nigeria said that 95% of Boko Haram fighters were either dead or had surrendered to the authorities. For over a decade, Islamist insurgents have carried out attacks and mass abductions in northern Nigeria, killing more than 40,000 people and displacing 2 million.
Myeni Jones. One of Haiti's most powerful gang leaders, Jimmy Cherizier, who's known as Barbecue, has said there will be civil war if Ariel Henry does not step down as prime minister. Mr. Henry, who'd been in Kenya trying to secure a multinational police force, is currently said to be in Puerto Rico after gangs attacked the international airport to prevent him returning home. Barbecue said he would stop at nothing to prevent the prime minister coming back.
We will fight Ariel Henry until the last drop of blood. We will fight Ariel Henry until he resigns. I am ready to make an alliance with the devil, ready to sleep in the same bed as the devil.
Nick Miles spoke to our correspondent in the region, Will Grant, about the influence of the armed gangs.
They really are in control of the vast majority of Port-au-Prince at the moment. It's said that it's over 80% of the city they control. And we've seen that they've launched attacks on the international airport. Of course, there was the shocking storming of prisons, seeing somewhere in the region of 4,000 inmates flee and escape from prison. So, yeah, they are very, very powerful, very well armed, and even if it wasn't such a kind of chaotic situation, almost a political vacuum going on, I think the authorities would struggle to contain them in the best of times, and this is far from the best of times.
And Will, are these gangs working together with a common aim in mind, or are they just out for whatever they can get from the situation? What do they want?
Jimmy Cherizier's gang is really a coalition of gangs. It's called G9, and it is several different large groups and very, very powerful ones at that. But it does seem that some of the other groups are similarly lined up against Ariel Henry, that he faces anarchy, really, a collective sense led by the gang world against his rule. Of course, there is not just him and his supporters who oppose that and people who want some form of stability, even if it is with the unelected prime minister until they can hold elections. But certainly Washington backs Ariel Henry. So, you know, it's a very, very difficult and violent situation.
And Mr. Henry was actually out of the country when all this happened. He'd been in Kenya signing a deal with the government there to bring in 1,000 Kenyan police to help with the overall security situation. From the outside, it seems unlikely, though, that even if they are forthcoming, 1,000 new Kenyan police against these gangs, would it make an awful lot of difference?
I mean, I don't think it's much of an exaggeration to say that Haiti is now teetering on the edge of becoming a failed state. So in that sense, no, 1,000 police officers from Kenya or really from anywhere else in the world is unlikely to make that much difference. That said, I think it's the sense that this would be an international force backed by the United Nations with the support of the United States with some funding, and that might have more clout to it than simply 1,000 officers on their own in the middle of the maelstrom. Nevertheless, yeah, it remains extremely chaotic, extremely violent, and even that situation where the Kenya police officers can't get off the ground because it's been deemed unconstitutional by Kenya's top court.
And briefly, Will, in the middle of all this, are the people trying to get by? It's awful for them, isn't it?
It is, and that's the thing that one keeps coming back to, you know, that this is schools shut down, businesses shuttered, and of course looting going on in neighbourhoods and gangs roaming the street with absolute impunity and total control. Yeah, it's horrific for those involved.
Will Grant. Tens of thousands of sea turtles die every year in the Mediterranean Sea after becoming entangled in fishing nets. But a new study has come up with a solution, putting green flashing lights on the nets. Researchers from the project, which involved the Society for the Protection of Turtles and Cypriot fishermen as well, say the battery-powered devices may cut the number of accidental catches and deaths by as much as half. Our environment correspondent Helen Briggs told us more.
They look to me a bit like the sort of lights that you might put on a bicycle. So obviously you wouldn't go out at night without lights on your bicycle. And this is doing a similar sort of thing, but you're attaching the lights to fishing ropes. And the idea really is to warn off sea turtles. We've got a lot of sea turtles in the Mediterranean Sea. It's an important breeding ground for green turtles, for loggerhead turtles. So the idea is if you can use these lights and attach them to fishing ropes, then you can reduce the number of accidental catches. So there has been some work before on this with lights. And this particular design was done by an English company developed by two brothers. One's an engineer, one's a biologist, and they want to try and get these lights used more widely. They're quite cheap to use. They just rely on batteries, so it's quite low tech. And the first trials off the coast of North Cyprus do seem to be producing some promising results. So it seems that you can almost halve accidental catching of sea turtles.
Yes, because I think there is one figure saying that as many as 40,000 turtles die every year in the Mediterranean because they get entangled in fishing lines. But how would this work when it comes to the fish themselves? Because clearly the fishermen want to catch fish. So did these lights not work with fishes? They don't see the lights.
Well, these first studies, it seems it doesn't actually have any effect on the commercial fishes that they're targeting. It's this accidental bycatch, as we call it, so accidental entanglement of species that you're not trying to catch, but they get caught up too, that they seem to be protecting. So in these studies, no marine mammals, sharks or seabirds were caught. So that's promising. But to put this into context, these turtles are facing a lot of hazards in the Mediterranean Sea. You know, this is a big problem for them. So this is where a lot of conservation efforts are going into preventing bycatch. But a lot of other work is needed as well. It's very busy oceans, there's shipping, there's development, there's pollution, there's degradation of the beaches where they nest. So it's one part of conservation work to try and protect sea turtles. And if you can protect skates and rays, they don't get as much attention maybe as sea turtles, but a lot of them are under threat of extinction. At the same time, there's going to be more research into this area, I think.
Helen Briggs. The Oscars will take place on Sunday, and it's easy to forget there are categories beyond the blockbuster awards for Best Film, Actor and Director. One of the smaller categories is Best Documentary Short, and among those nominated this year is The Last Repair Shop, about a small warehouse in Los Angeles where craftspeople carry out repairs on musical instruments for school kids. It's directed by Ben Proudfoot and Chris Bowers and features Dwayne Michael, who's a musician in his own right and now repairs the woodwind instruments in the workshop.
When producers Ben and Chris came to the shop, I was just one of the four that pretty much said, sure, I'd love to be a part of it. I was a nervous wreck the whole day.
I love the violin. The hardest things in my life is probably my family's health. Like everybody's always getting sick back to back.
Even though I repair, you know, trumpets and did some string repair as well, but When I was hired on, in the woodwind section, because that's the opening that was available. And of course, that's the saxophones and flutes and clarinets and all of, you know, in that category. And I got my wonderful and enjoyable bench that I sit at. I start working on the saxophones, clarinets, whatever happens to be on the list for that day. So that's kind of how the day starts for me.
The saxophone helped me in a way be more disciplined, because music, okay, I have to be on time, I have to practice, I have to look good, I have to shower, I have to brush my teeth. It helped me focus more.
I've always been into tinkering with things. As a little kid, I remember the Legos and stuff. I would want to build. I would want to make things work. And so I always had that interest. And even before the film, we've always been like a family in there. Knowing that the instruments are going back to the student, you can almost see in your mind, you know, when they get their instrument back, they're going to be smiling and happy. And of course, we clean out the cases and we wipe everything down and make the instrument look as nice as we can when they get it back. It's kind of a driving force that, at least personally, that keeps me going.
When I'm feeling tense, when I'm feeling sad or angry, the saxophone. Calms me down.
Even if one or two of the kids that play on the instruments that I repaired go on to great things, you know, it's just so worth it. Even if these students don't go on to be well-known players or musicians, and maybe after school or college they go on to other things, it really helps you when you're young. I know it has helped me. Even if I didn't stick with it, it helped me to be more attentive, to know what it's like to put in time and learn something and get something out of it. I think that's what keeps me going and keeps me enjoying the work that I do. We did a few days ago find out that the four of us craftspeople, myself, Dana, Patty, and Steve, we'll be going to the Academy Awards. And it's, that's very surreal, very unbelievable. But yes, we will be able to attend. I'm very grateful and nervous too, in a good way.
That was Duane Michael. And the documentary is available for streaming on YouTube and the Los Angeles Times website. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Abby Wiltshire. The producer was Judy Frankel. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Hey, Hotels.com here. Tired of living like a sardine? We know a hotel where you can enjoy the open ocean. Book hotels with ocean views in the Hotels.com app. Find your perfect somewhere.